This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Before a single opening statement in a courtroom, everyone is already pulling harder on the steering wheel than ever, either the prosecution or the defense. In the case against Brian Koberger, the judge isn't just keeping order, he's directing traffic. Whole swaths of evidence are getting clipped out. Words like murder, psychopath, and even the term touch DNA are being treated like they're radioactive. Meanwhile, evidence like the K-bar knife and the order from Amazon and DNA on the sheath are left at the scene. It's all in. Game on! Begs the question, what's more important in a trial like this, the evidence itself or the legal scaffolding that tells the jury what to even pay attention to? Joining us is someone who knows the rules, has enforced them, and has even worked with evidence that can make or break a federal case. Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent, host of the Break the Case podcast. She's here. Let's not, you know, tiptoe at this. When you see a judge toss out words like psychopath and clamp down on forensic lingo while allowing the heavily curated Amazon history in, what's your first instinct here? Is this all on track? Is the judge doing a good job thus far into the case? Or is he boxing things in a bit too much? Where do you stand?
I think the judge, Judge Hippler, is doing a great job. I don't think you should be able to say psychopath, and there was another word. He's actually allowing
sociopath,
murder and murder.
Yeah.
Because you should be, it's a murder trial.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But he got rid of the, you know, psychopath, sociopath, those are out. And I think, in my opinion, the biggest mistake so far succinctly regarding the trial has been made by Ann Taylor. And that was to ask for touch DNA, trace DNA, contact DNA. Those three words cannot be said by any DNA expert on their side or the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And because guess what, Tony? Now they get to use the word DNA. And that is so much stronger than touch, trace, or contact. So in my opinion, she did not foresee what that meant, asking that. And so now they get to say DNA. DNA was there. DNA was there. And the jury is going to hear that much stronger than trace DNA. That's my opinion.
That to me is like a shocking error, if that's what that was on her part. Was she thinking that, okay, if we get rid of touch, trace, and contact DNA, that the whole word DNA is just not going to be allowed in? And she just failed to, like, mention DNA in general? Because that to me is, I don't know. I mean, I'm not an attorney, but I look at that and go, yeah, those sound a lot more confusing and a lot less powerful than just DNA.
No, I agree. I think what happened is, obviously, they're going to be able to discuss it.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be able to say it wasn't from hair, blood, or semen.
Yeah.
They're going to say it's, but they can't say, like I said, contact, touch, or trace.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to be able to explain it, but still the jury is going to hear probably hundreds of times, DNA, DNA, DNA. Mm-hmm. And I think she made a big mistake. I wouldn't have touched that with a 10-foot pole. It's in her expert's report. It's in the prosecution's expert's report because it's a specific kind of DNA.
Yeah.
Just like blood. Blood is not DNA. DNA is in blood and in hair and in semen, right? So to be able to describe where the DNA was located is critical, and she took that component out.
It makes me wonder a little bit because she's a pretty competent attorney. I mean, she's arguing like every possible thing she could possibly argue in this case, even if it's somewhat ridiculous. But I'm wondering how much Koberger is doing an influence on this, where I wonder how much of an idea that was his, saying, I want that out. That should not be in there because it's going to make people think this. And because his thinking is a bit skewed and not necessarily in line with the rest of the world, if that's, you know, one of his ideas and she's doing, you know, what the client is asking.
I see him and I don't know, but I see that his role would probably be more of like a research assistant, that she has him pouring through everything, looking for little nuggets. Certainly, I think he's very involved in his defense, but Ann Taylor is a very strong personality. She's a strong advocate. I think she's done a good job from the standpoint of that strength. I think the fact that she just throws everything up against the wall, Tony, I think it tends to diminish those important items she goes for. In other words, when you start just seeing everything's being challenged, it just loses, I think, the punch that it would have had if she just would have focused on the more important details.
The fact that she is going after literally everything, what does that tell you about the integrity of their case?
They have no case. They're throwing up prayers. They don't have the facts working for them, Tony. Mm-hmm. And when you have a case that you just are at a huge factual deficit, what are you going to do other than just send Hail Mary after Hail Mary and hopefully, you know, somebody catches it. But it's rough for them. And now the eyebrows are in too. And that is another biggie.
Yeah.
You know, they tried to get Dylan Mortensen's testimony about the bushy eyebrows out because now they have that picture 10:30 in the morning, right after the, you know, the crimes were committed of those huge bushy eyebrows. And, you know, we all commented the first time we saw him in court, geez, they are manicuring those now. I should say we saw him in court with a suit on, his hair gelled and looking good, him all manicured, and those eyebrows went from big caterpillars to little ones.
Yeah, that photo, that selfie, maybe one of his biggest regrets, I would think, maybe at this point in time. And in the far cry that he's innocent, even more so, if that would be the case, because it does not look good in any way, shape, or form. Let's talk about the K-Bar knife a little bit. Obviously, he purchased that well before the crimes actually took place. It arrived to his parents' home out in Pennsylvania, and then obviously would have traveled back with him to Idaho and to Washington. We got that. Obviously, it doesn't look good that you bought the exact type of weapon and sheath and sharpener that was used to commit a crime. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's the exact one. People do buy these things all the time. But it's not so much the purchase that is going to be strong here. It's the click history, because it's not just, okay, I bought this. It's, what are you looking at? How often are you looking at it? How damning is that going to be now that we know his history of looking at it before the crime, but also after the crime?
Right. That's the big thing. A couple of things there. So first of all, you know, the defense is trying to say, listen, anybody could have bought that and had it shipped to them at their household. But the problem is, it's going to, I think, from what I've seen from the documents, they're going to have the credit card information and they're going to have the click history on his computer that matches up with the order. So there's going to be no doubt it's him, number one. Number two, you're exactly right. After the murders, he was looking for a replacement K-bar, like most of us, not most of us, many of us have been saying from day one, if he committed this crime, our belief is this was just the beginning. You know, this is somebody who truly was capable of being a serial killer and mentally. And then the fact that he bought it early, again, back to what many of us have said, and that is he planned this, dreamed about it, thought about it, and you know, in his mind played it out so many times. So I'm not surprised at all that it was well in advance.
Way back, because like the, I think we like, but 9 months is as far back as we know about purchases go, between the mask where you could see his eyebrows and the K-bar knife and such. Do you think all that way back he had his targets in mind, or was it more of a fantasy at that moment and he knew he was going to eventually hone in on someone to execute this sick fantasy of his, allegedly?
I think B, you know, your latter explanation, he had an idea of what they would look like. He had an idea of what they would be like, act like, you know, the person that they could never get, never be with, the person that represented all he wasn't. And once he put his eyes on that and made his target, he was ready.
Let's talk about some of the cell tower data. Obviously, they say they have their guy that's going to say that, well, this shows he was nowhere near the crime scene based on his interpretation of cell tower data. But the problem is between 2:54 a.m. and 4:48 a.m., his phone wasn't on. So no one has that data. All we have is where it came back on, where he was going initially, where he left, or where he picked up from, which showed he was leaving the general area. How are they going to argue that? How are they going to go and say, okay, this geo data that you have somehow supersedes the experts that we have that are showing us? No, I mean, look, he's been kind of surveilling the house. It goes dark. He could have gone anywhere at that point in time. And when it picks back up, it shows he's leaving the general area. That just, I mean, it does not seem like a strong argument at all, but they don't really seem to have a whole lot of arguments to go with here.
Well, the two big pieces that really came forward very recently, one of them very recently, was that phone was physically turned off.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, initially the defense was sort of saying, oh, you know, it's, they don't have cell phone towers out there, blah, blah, blah. It just lost signal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, now we know, at least according to the latest documents, no, it was physically turned off and turned back on. That, to me, the jury is just going to eat that up, Tony. I think jurors are so smart. I really do. Maybe I've just had such great, luck with every jury trial that I've been involved with. I mean, they see it.
Mm-hmm.
They really do most of the time. You can't pull the wool over their eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to see that. Oh, my gosh, you turned it off right before the crimes were committed and then turned it back on right after?
Yeah.
I think it's really, really compelling. But as far as what do you do when you have one expert saying this and the other expert saying that? Well, I will say in a lot of trials, when you talk to the jurors afterwards, the experts for them just negate one another and it kind of becomes white noise in the background. Considering all the money that is paid for these experts, lawyers might not want to hear that. But if you don't have one to counter the other, then it looks like you're just capitulating the argument. So you have to have it.
Mm-hmm.
But in my experience, typically the jurors are like, yeah, this one's paid by the defense. This one's hired by the prosecution. They negate each other. They're both going to say what they were paid to do. All right, let's move on to the facts.
And people can connect the dots.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.